Good morning, all. Our first case for argument this morning is the United States versus Neighbors et al. And Mr. O'Daniel, it's your turn.
Thank you. May it please the court. This case comes to the court today by virtue of a guilty verdict in the United States District Court convicting David Neighbors, Kamal Sims, Frederick Taylor, and Trevor Perry of various counts of conspiracy to deliver controlled substances, and then there's a one firearm allegation specific to Mr. Perry. They were sentenced to life, 20 years, 20 years, and 327 months accordingly. This court has jurisdiction pursuant to 28 U.S.C. 1291, 1294, and 18 U.S.C. 3742. As I indicated, we have split up the various arguments accordingly, and I would be addressing the first two of the arguments, the first being that of an improper jury and motion for mistrial accordingly. The second issue that I would address is that of the allowance of extrinsic evidence to be presented during deliberations to the jury. The first issue is that of an improper jury. In this particular trial, approximately 80 individuals were called as part of the NIRE, and not a single one of them was of African-American ethnic background.
Mr. O'Daniel, I can't see how we could possibly rule in your favor without overruling, to use an odd term, the Supreme Court's decision in Duren against Missouri, and so obviously we can't do that. So I'm not sure if you're just raising this to present it later to the Supreme Court, or whether you think there's actually some room somewhere for us.
I think that's a good observation, because I think that's essentially what I am doing, is one, preserving it for potential future appeal. I also think that while Duren controls, and I think I acknowledge that within the brief, it does present a near impossibility for any criminal defendant to meet the burden that Duren sets out. There are three prongs, the first being that of a distinctive class, and there's nobody that indicates in this trial, including the U.S. attorney, that indicated that an African-American was not a distinct class of individuals. The second prong...
I know that there are those three prongs, but what I would suggest to you, you know, apart from the fact that you're certainly free to raise this, and we can acknowledge that you have preserved the point, But there are other places in the system where we try to assure the integrity of the voir dire when courts set up their jury plans. I mean, there's a lot of review, and we have not typically done it at the stage where the voir dire has actually been assembled, if there's no reason to think there's systematic exclusion.
That's correct, Your Honor. However, when going through the three prongs, the second prong, and in the Ashley Court, it says that if there's less than a 10% differential, that's not good enough. And obviously we've not presented the percentages of African Americans within the particular Southern District of Indiana. It would, if 10% is the threshold for prong two, then no minority of under 10% would ever be able to meet the second prong. The third prong never even gets to it, the systematic exclusion. And so what we're saying is, we show up day of court, we look back there, and we see 80 individuals because the jury questionnaires are devoid of any racial connotation, and we see that. The other part, and so we're ill-prepared at that level to make a systematic exclusion argument. There are many prongs to that. We would have to go to Indianapolis, see who didn't return the jury questionnaires, because that's really what it amounts to. It's not so much the people that show up, it's the ones that don't. And the people that actually brought it to our attention were two jurors. It was during questions, you know, would you want to be a juror in this particular situation? And one of the jurors, and it was echoed by another juror, said, well, you know, I'm from Florida, and, you know, I'm just kind of looking around here, and they're all black and we're all white. I'm not sure that I feel real comfortable in that. Now, the court did it.
Wasn't that juror struck, though? One of the jurors...
No. I believe one of the jurors was remained on the jury panel. And, of course, the judge did what he should and asked each individual juror if race made any difference and if they could listen to the evidence accordingly. And, of course, they all said absolutely they could. again, it's really not so much as the people that brought it, because those are the ones that are aware of what's going on and maybe have a little more of a sensitivity towards the issue. Really, the ones that we have potential problems with are the ones that noticed it and said nothing. And again, I invite the court to revisit that. Obviously, this may or may not be the proper forum to do so, but we look at systematic exclusion and we look at those issues by which are how our system works. And clearly, we have to put out some jury selection process and in some manner that we determine is fair. But there are certain anomalies that happen within the context of findings by juries, people who show up, whatever it might be. And at some point, the judges, whether it be the district court or here at the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court, have some authority to say, you know what, this doesn't appear to be fair today. If a jury came back and they said, you know, we're going to find him guilty, the judge does have some power to override a jury decision.
Okay.
So, too, in a situation where a civil matter, if a jury comes back with punitive awards of $200 million, they can reduce that as well, because even though juries are supposed to be, you know, the jury of your peers and listen to all the evidence, sometimes they're wrong.
Could before you have to sit down, I wanted a clarification from you about your other point.
Yes.
Because when I read your brief, it sounded as though the transcripts were not admitted into evidence. And then I look at page 9 of the government's brief, and I read, the district court upheld the government's argument and admitted the transcripts into evidence. And then the transcripts everybody agrees, go back to the jury room. So are they admitted into evidence or not?
I don't believe they were, Your Honor. Record page 246 through 248, also record page 265, 270.
Right, those are some of the same pages of government.
It all indicates that, the court was clear, it's pretty law that the transcripts are not allowed as evidence.
Well, that's different from admitting them as an exhibit, though. I mean, the judge said all the things he should have said about relying on the oral transcripts and the oral tapes, the oral recordings and not the transcripts. But transcripts are admitted as exhibits frequently.
Breland certainly allows for it.
It looks like these were. That's what I'm confused.
Yeah, Breland certainly allows for it. And the government made a motion on page 246 of the transcript to introduce exhibits 101 through 326, I believe is the number. At no point does the court say they are admitted.
Well, the court overrules the objection.
There was an objection,
and then the objection was overruled, and implicitly the exhibits were admitted because later on they're distributed to the jurors in the jury box while testimony about the tapes is ongoing.
Yeah, and clearly we objected to that. They were the court never uses the word they are admitted. The court did say that the it could be distributed as an aid to listen to the audio tape as we go along.
What does the clerk's exhibit list indicate?
I'm sorry?
The clerk's exhibit.
I do not have that information here. So I can't answer that question.
Mr. Daniel, just two questions, if I might. With regard to your observation of the jury pool initially, I think I understood you to say you and co-counsel examined the pool visually. At that point, did you register a objection before proceeding to examination?
We did not, Your Honor. And clearly there's a case that indicates that you must raise that prior to voir dire examination or 7 days after it became observable. Again, perhaps it's some fault to our own, but clearly this was not a situation that we even thought we'd address, no advance notice, so to speak. And it wasn't until the jurors themselves brought it to our attention that we looked out and realized that, hey, we may have a problem here.
I want to track that.
Sure.
You're saying counsel come in, examine, and it's jurors who need to point out to you the apparent composition, racial composition of the pool?
It's not the juror's obligation.
What in fact occurred. My concern, and I appreciate the argument you're making on Durham, But if your challenge is that second prong threshold can't be met, that seems to be observable. I mean, if you're going to make a predicate argument here, don't you need to say we can't go forward with this pool because it wouldn't allow us to make the challenge? I guess that's...
We actually did ask for that. Of course, it wasn't prior to the voir dire examination starting. It was only once the juror mentioned something about race.
How did that question occur? What triggered a juror? Was that a volunteered statement, or were you making inquiry of the jury about being uncomfortable in the setting?
Mr. Gross was the attorney that was examining the juror at that point.
He'll enlighten us.
However, my recollection was that the juror was simply asked, "Would you want to be a juror today?" And you know, just in a
generic, "Do you want to serve?"
Yeah, kind of in that context. And it was at that point that they made their own observations. At which point, we all kind of, "Hey, there is a problem here, perhaps." So now
at that point, did you suggest to the court that we can't proceed with this pool?
Yes, it was. And we made various arguments throughout the course of day and the following day.
Aware of that, yeah. Okay.
But going back to the transcripts, certainly the extrinsic evidence is the court certainly has the discretion to introduce transcripts. Whether they did in this case or not, I think, is debatable. But nevertheless, the jurors were allowed to see the transcripts. It's clear throughout the course of the entire trial that the court admonished the jury that this was not evidence. Now, the court has a lot of latitude in what goes back, whether it be exhibits or otherwise, during deliberations. And in this case, the court myself noticed that one of the jurors was taking the transcript book back to deliberations, at which point the court properly said, no, go get those books back, bring them back in here. That's not evidence. And it wasn't until they had questions about it during deliberations that they were allowed to go back in over our objection. I think the Zambrana case is
just for a limited purpose. Weren't they trying to figure out whose testimony they needed to hear again?
Well, and I think there are other ways by which that could be done, whether it be listening to the entire transcript themselves, because we argued, and I think rightfully so, that the cover sheets, we never complained that the transcripts themselves, the verbatim, was wrong, but it contained opinion information that we found very objectionable because it alleged that certain people were on various calls. Mm-hmm. And that kind of goes to the voice identification issue that Ms. Williams will raise as well.
Okay.
But clearly, if we're going to start allowing extrinsic evidence, things that may aid the jury in their deliberations, then so too we're going to allow Bibles and we're going to allow Black's Law dictionaries, which clearly under Rios Calderon are not available without some sort of consent on both parties.
Now, just before you sit down, Mr. Daniel, and I won't take time from others by my inquiry to you, just so I understand your challenge on Durham and what you'd want to preserve or what you want us to look at, and I understand your argument, I think I do anyway, is it your view that in this case, if the trial judge made the same observation that you said was brought to your attention by a juror, before anything started, he or she, as a trial judge, shouldn't commence a trial where there is a substantial number, if not entirely, of a particular minority, and there is no representation, so that pool can't even, you can't commence inquiry in that pool because of your argument about the 10%? So is it the judge's responsibility, you're saying? I know I inquired of the lawyer's responsibility before.
I think it's.
Is that your argument?
I think it's the system's responsibility.
I appreciate the system's concern. We've got to come up,
yes,
or at a level higher than us, with a workable, practical solution to this challenge.
Sure.
I'm asking you, if 60 or 80 members of a pool come in the Southern District of Indiana or anywhere in our circuit, And it does not seem that there's any minority representation, so your point being you can't get to a threshold challenge if you've got minority members, that inquiry of that jury shouldn't proceed?
I believe that's true.
All right. I just want to frame that argument.
Sure.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
All right. Ms. Williams? morning.
Good morning. Please, the court. My name is Barbara Williams. I represented LaFrederick Taylor in this trial, and I'm here this morning to address the argument which was raised third in our brief concerning the identification of the voices of appellants Sims and LaFrederick Taylor. Your Honor, we understand and we agree with the Alvarez case that voice recordings, identification through voice recording is admissible only if the government can establish by clear and convincing evidence that the recordings are true, accurate, and are authentic recordings of the conversations. That's essentially Federal Rule of Evidence 901B5, and there's been a number of cases which have addressed that issue. We believe that in this case the government's proof falls far short of what's required in order to establish the reliability of this evidence. In Manson versus Brathwaite, which is followed in the cases Alvarez and Mansouri and Resendez, which are the principal cases addressing these issues today, held that reliability is the linchpin, and it is through the process of analysis, various factors, that the government is able to produce sufficiently reliable evidence to meet the requirements of Rule 901, Evidence Rule 901.
But Ms. Williams, once the government has put someone on the stand who says, I talked to this individual and I think this voice in the tape is the person with whom I had a conversation, even if it's in the courtroom, by the way, why isn't everything else just a question of weight that the jury wants to give to that person's opinion? If they talk to them for 5 minutes, maybe the jury gives it a little less weight. If they talk to them for 20 minutes, maybe more. If they talk to them every day of their life, you know, maybe it's very heavy weight. But it seems to me once the witness is willing to testify, I am testifying based on firsthand knowledge of this person's voice, then everything else really is credibility and weight.
Well, Your Honor, I agree that is the case. However, in this case, I believe, especially with respect to Sims and my client, LaFrederick Taylor, that fundamental wasn't established. In Mr. Taylor's case, it was the only evidence with respect to the reliability, with respect to my client's identification, was offered through Detective Simpson, who simply said, "I heard him at some point in court."
I thought Simpson interviews Sims for 10 minutes after the arrest, and with Taylor it is in court, but doesn't 901 just say at any time, and why wouldn't that include in court?
Well, Your Honor, I think if we look at the test that's applied with Resendez with respect to what's constitutionally reliable, I think that the procedure that the government used in this case is not adequate to meet even that minimum level of reliability.
Did you move to suppress the IDs under Manson versus Brathwaite?
I don't believe we did. We objected to the identification, but we didn't move to suppress under Manson versus Brathwaite.
I understood your argument to be one of evidentiary admissibility under the rules of evidence and not a constitutional-based argument for an unduly suggestive ID procedure in violation of due process. I know that there's a self-incrimination argument that you're making.
Yes, Your Honor.
Based on those IDs that were based in part on in-court statements of at least one or perhaps two of the defendants.
Your Honor, I
didn't understand you to be making an unduly suggestive ID an argument because there was no such motion to suppress
the IDs.
We did not
make that motion, although we objected from the very beginning to the identification of the voices by the...
You've got to make the motion if you want it suppressed. I mean, you can object on evidentiary grounds during the course of trial if you've got an evidentiary argument against admissibility, but if you've got a constitutionally based argument based on an unduly suggestive ID procedure, I think you've got to make that motion ahead of time.
Well, there wasn't a motion made ahead of time, Your Honor. That motion was made prior to the receiving of any identification evidence after Detective Freiberger offered testimony with respect to the number of phone calls that were were reviewed and the manner in which the police officers went about the process of determining who the witnesses were. Part of our analysis in this case was that there were so many calls. There were 27,000 calls listened to, and Detective Simpson and Detective Freiberger were the two main witnesses. They testified variously that there were 1,100 to 1,400 calls that they considered to be pertinent. Detective Freiberger was cross-examined about the manner in which they determined who the phone calls were made by. He testified that it was a process that was done over months of time, that there were 9 or 10 different police officers who were involved, that the actual decision about who made the calls was not made until a month before trial, that Detective Simpson and Detective Simpson did not talk to my client, Mr. Taylor, at any time. And we believe that if you apply the analysis that this court applied in the Biggers analysis that this court applied in the Resendez case, that the government's presentation falls short of what is fundamentally required. The second question after the reliability question is whether or not it's constitutionally reliable, and we believe that in this case, as I said, the government fell far short. Some of the different factors that this court has taken into account before are whether or not there are other witnesses who can have heard the witness's testimony, whether or not that there are any other indices of a reliability. For example, in Mr. Taylor's case, there were, in any of the calls that are attributed to him, there is not any subscriber that's attributed to him. There was no telephone in his possession at the time he was arrested. The analysis with respect to the Resendez case, where it discusses the factors concerning the length of time that the officer heard the voice, the fact that he heard the voice at the time of the arrest and listened to a specific phone call.
Counsel, if I could interrupt for a minute, because you didn't make this sort of a motion or this sort of an argument on appeal, I'd like to ask if you are covering or if one of your co-counsel will be covering the other evidentiary argument in this case having to do with Kareem Davidovich's testimony.
I think that'll be Mr. Grove's argument.
Okay. Then you can continue with yours, and I'll save my questions on that for him.
But we believe, Your Honor, that the government relies in its brief on Resendez as providing that even a small amount or any kind of identification is appropriate, and we believe that the analysis of Resendez does not support the government's position, but rather supports our position that these identifications were so flawed that they didn't meet the fundamental requirements. In the fourth factor that's discussed is that the agent expressed no uncertainty at all after hearing the voice during the arrest and also post-arrest, and the court finally found that admissibility was favored in that case because the agent listened to a specific phone call on the same day as he participated in the arrest. And in the case that we have, we've indicated before, that there were so many phone calls and so many. This is a case where there were more than 20, or almost nearly 20 people arrested on the same day. And we don't believe that Officer Simpson or Officer Freiberger was taking the proper steps to specifically identify each of the individuals, and that this process took place. And again, this relates to our argument with respect to the cover sheets, is that the officers put it together at the right before trial, backed into it, so to speak, and attributed identification to particular individuals with nothing to back it up. And that's especially true in, I think, Mr. Taylor's case, because as I indicated, there was nothing else that tied him to these telephone calls. The phone numbers weren't in his name. The subscribers weren't related to him in any way, shape, or form. There was no telephone found on him when he was arrested. There were a mere 13 phone calls out of the almost 300 that were presented that were attributed to him with no factors that would meet the requirements of the reliability standard. We believe, for these reasons, that the identification is flawed, and that because of that, that the that the government or that the court abused its discretion when it allowed the identification.
Ms. Van, can I just ask one area of inquiry? What was the time frame for the overhearings? How long did they go on?
90 days. There were three 30-day wiretap orders. I think it was from the middle of May to the middle of August.
And do we know what officers listened to those?
We know that that Special Agent Freiberg and Special Agent Simpson did. They were two of the main FBI officers, but Officer Freiberg testified that over the course of that time, there were 9 or 10 or more officers or individuals that he oversaw who were listening to telephone calls.
And did the identification at trial?
Detective Simpson did all of the identification at trial.
And did he participate in overhearings during the 90 days?
Yes, he did.
So he's a transactional witness as well as someone who listened to the tapes after the fact and made the IDs?
I think that's correct.
Well, that's reliable by definition if he's part of the transaction. He's listening to the voices as they're coming in.
Well, Your Honor, there was considerable discussion and cross-examination about that with respect to the number of calls that were made and the fact that he couldn't identify. I mean, he was there, with respect to the specific 300 calls that were made, nobody testified that I listened to this call and then I listened to this person testify and I linked them up. Detective Freiberger said that was a process that included 9 or 10 different individuals and took place over several months period of time. And then upon further examination, Detective Freiberger indicated that they selected the 300-plus calls to be received into evidence a month before trial, which would have been almost a year or more after the 90-day period. And that was done prior to trial, and there's no indication that at that time either of those witnesses did anything to specifically determine whether or not the call was made by the person it was being attributed to.
Thank you, Ms. Williams.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Groves?
Yes, sir. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Chad Groves. I represented David Neighbors as court-appointed counsel at the trial of this matter. I will be addressing, sir and ma'am, the fourth issue raised on appeal regarding the admissibility or the various issues regarding Kareem Davidovic, the government star witness who was an unindicted co-conspirator. He was called to testify as to his dealings or various activities between Kareem Davidovic and the other players or indicted co-conspirators at trial.
My primary question about this part of the case,
yes, ma'am,
is even if the district court didn't draw quite the right line between Rule 608 and Rule 613, there is so much evidence in this case. Wouldn't that just be harmless error?
I've thought of that, Your Honor, and there's no way I can put myself in the jury room during deliberations and speculate as to what the jury based their decision on or what evidence they chose to add weight to. I think a live witness is better than phone calls or other paper exhibits. Considering the verdict, and I think perhaps Mr. Tullis will address this, I'm not for sure, but one of the defendants was acquitted and the verdicts for the other three were not the same on the verdict forms. So apparently the jury had some questions about guilt or innocence during deliberations. But I don't know the answer.
So wasn't this Haitian man, whoever he was, whether it's Cadet or whether it's somebody else, awfully tangential to the defendant's work?
Well, I believe the Haitian is specifically identified on Government's Exhibit 230 and 231 as a participant in some of these phone calls, also as a co-conspirator, although he was not indicted as neither was Kareem Davidovich. Specifically, I think the inquiry is, was this evidence sought to be introduced extrinsic or not? My argument is that it was not extrinsic. It goes specifically to the issues at hand regarding the conspiracy and people involved in the conspiracy.
I think, counsel, the threshold question is whether it's character evidence or some other form of impeachment. Before we would get to the question of whether it's extrinsic or not. If it's not character evidence, it doesn't come within the ambit of Rule 608B's prohibition on proof of other acts going to character via extrinsic evidence. It just comes in as other impeachment evidence under Rule 613. Right?
Well, Your Honor, Mr. Davidovich was specifically asked, I believe by myself, if he had ever lied about other members of the conspiracy or stated he had done so. I don't think that necessarily goes to his character as a liar or not, but it goes to his specific actions with regard to this conspiracy, impeachment.
You have a little more time?
Yes, Your Honor, and I would just address the question you had of Mr. O'Daniel about my inquiry into the prospective juror.
Sure.
I'd ask, I believe specifically, if the prospective juror were seated at the defendant's table and were a defendant in the case, would they want themselves on the jury? And that's when he expressed, well, if I was seated over there at the defendant's table, I would be a little concerned about the racial makeup of the
so
jury.
The response carried the comment about race, not the question.
Yes.
Well, I mean, you were just asking.
I was asking if he
would you trade places? Would you want to be?
Yes, Your Honor.
In the other person's seat. I understand.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Tellis?
Please report. My name is John Tullis, and I represented Trevor Perry at the trial. Mr. Perry was found guilty of a conspiracy under 841, but it was a lesser included, if you will, due to the amount of weight involved. He was acquitted of the firearms charge. I'm addressing points 5 and 6 that are raised in the brief. The indictment in this case, pled a conspiracy to distribute both crack and powder cocaine. And the jury returned a verdict. However, as regards Sims, Taylor, and Perry, and there was no powder cocaine conspiracy involved, we argued at the trial court that this was an acquittal, a constructive acquittal. And we raised that issue with the court. We said there's inconsistent verdicts because you have gentlemen who are charged with two crimes, essentially, but there's only proof as to one. Now, the indictment was amended.
But how is this different from cases like, I mean, we have a lot of cases where the government charges in an indictment a couple of different ways to commit a crime. Here it's the crime of a conspiracy to distribute a controlled substance. So United States against Kincaid, for example, there are several different ways of establishing an interstate commerce connection. The government uses the conjunctive in those, and yet we say any one of them is enough to prove the crime. So why isn't it the same here? When they charge in the conjunctive, crack and powder, since those are not elements of the offense, they're just two different ways of committing the underlying offense. It's a little bit bizarre if you were an English major, but it seems to me that that's well established in the law.
It's what's wrong about it is, and as this court has said in the Lake case, that there's a requirement of notice that the defendant be put on notice, essentially, of what he's been charged with. He or
she's been charged on plenty of notice that he's been charged with crack. I mean, surely you're not saying that somebody who sees you've been charged with distributing both crack and powder is going to say, well, all I have to do is disprove the powder part and I'm home free. That would be so inconsistent with a long line of cases.
The trial required the defendants in this case to defend against basically crack and powder, and there was no evidence as to powder, as the cocaine hydrochloride.
How did that disadvantage you in preparing the defense, Mr. Tullis?
Well, you're looking for evidence of powder, cocaine, evidence of transactions, evidence of sales. And you're waiting for that to sort of come out of the box when it's not there. All the United States had to do was amend and recharge, which they had done previously before. The Sterone case, it's a 1960 case at the Supreme Court, said you have a Hobbs Act violation where you allege the movement of sand in interstate commerce. And at trial, you put into proof evidence of steel and sand. And the court said, no, that's, you know, that conviction is going to be reversed. That's improper under the
but that's not your case. You weren't charged with the steel in the Sterone case. Here you're charged with both the crack and the powder. Maybe you did have to prepare more than you would have had to because you thought there might be powder evidence. But it seems to me there's plenty of notice in your case of what you're being accused of.
The Cusimano case sort of addressed this, and it basically reversed Mr. Cusimano's conviction where the indictment alleged extortion by wrongful use of fear or of economic harm. While at trial it was physical extortion or extortion by threats of violence and physical harm. So you've got a situation there where he was given some notice, but then the proof varied, and if it varies impermissibly, such as it did here in this case, then that is improper. For that reason, this court should reverse what the trial court refused to do. The government, again, had the opportunity to have pled or in their indictment, or they could have amended, knowing full well that there was not any evidence of powder cocaine as to Sims, Taylor, and Perry. So I think that when you have a material variance in the Warden case, which is a Seventh Circuit case, side stands with the fact when you have a material variance, at trial, that's fatal, and that requires a dismissal. And for those reasons, the convictions as to all defendants should be reversed and set aside. The other issue I wanted to address concerns specifically my client, Mr. Perry. Now, Mr. Perry went to trial with the other gentlemen in the case, David Neighbors, Kamal Sims, LaFrederick Taylor, and Mr. Stansfield. Mr. Stansfield was acquitted and is not part of this appeal, but he was found guilty, he being Perry, was found guilty of a conspiracy involving less than 5 grams of crack cocaine. Under the sentencing statute, his sentencing options were 0 to 360 months, 0 to 30 years. Mr. Sims and Mr. Taylor, who were found guilty of being involved in a conspiracy to distribute 5 grams or more, sentenced to 240 months.
But basically, Mr. Perry's a career offender.
Mr. Perry did have a significant record, but his involvement in this case was much lower.
I understand that, but if he's a career offender, then he moves over to a different part of the guidelines for sentencing.
He does. He does have some guideline, some heavy guideline liability. Sims and Taylor could have been sentenced to life, but weren't. Could have been sentenced to life under the statute, but were not.
But Congress has decided that career offenders need more sentencing, undoubtedly for specific deterrence and for other reasons, perhaps protection of the community as well, thinking of 3553A. So, I mean, I understand that this was a long sentence given just the amount of the cocaine that he was dealing in, but this is a structure that Congress has established and the Sentencing Commission has implemented. It's hard to say that the district court made a mistake by following it.
I submit to this court that I believe Mr. Perry was arbitrarily singled out under these facts with his involvement in this case. And I'll just, again, cite the court to the Wiley case, which has been cited in my brief, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Tullis. Mr. Blackington?
Thank you. Thank you very much. May it please the court. I think that most of the issues that the appellants have raised have been either directly resolved or pretty close to directly resolved by either Supreme Court or Seventh Circuit opinion. So I wanted to start with the two issues that are maybe a little bit off the beaten path, as it were, and might require a little bit more elaboration. The first is the are the Karim Davidovic letters. As the court has no doubt looked at the record, the procedure under which these letters came in as the defense attempted to introduce them to impeach Mr. Davidovic, I objected to it, and the court excused the jury and permitted defense counsel to examine Mr. Davidovic based upon these letters as an offer of proof. As the offer of proof was developed, only one of the four letters was referred to, and only part of the letter. And in the letter, part of the letter that was referred to, Mr. Davidovic said, "I did lie on that Haitian," and he used the N-word. "I said he used to serve me my blow. You know that I've never effed with him." I objected to that under Rule 608B as extrinsic evidence, and that the letters were used as specific acts of conduct to support his character for untruthfulness.
Is that really the case, though? Isn't this just standard impeachment by prior inconsistent statement, in which case it's provable by extrinsic evidence, as long as the witness has an opportunity to see and explain it?
I don't think that's the case when you look at the Reddit and Dawson cases, where similar types of evidence were treated under the scope of Rule 608B. In the Reddit case, the defendant had filled out an employment application and had failed to disclose the existence of the conviction.
Right, but that's a situation where the lie on the employment application was had nothing to do with the prosecution, right? And the line of questioning here had everything to do with this prosecution because it involved one of the co-conspirators, right?
It didn't have everything to do with the prosecution in this case. The Davidovic letter refers to a Haitian man. There was some evidence at trial of a Haitian person who was involved in a drug transaction, which would have been Selmo Cadet. There's nothing in the letter or otherwise that would connect the Haitian man referred to by Davidovic to Selmo Cadet. And as I laid out in sort of an offer of proof when the when this objection was being made, I had interviewed Mr. Davidovic on several occasions. Agent Freiberger was present on every occasion where Mr. Davidovic was interviewed, and Mr. Davidovic never said anything at all about Selmo Cadet or any other Haitian person.
Was he asked?
Was he asked during, when I interviewed him, he was not asked about it. He was asked generically, okay, who are the other people that you've dealt with who you know sell crack? I asked him that question. He'd never talked about Selmo Cadet or another Haitian person.
But Selmo Cadet was tangentially involved, at least, with this particular drug scheme, wasn't he?
He was tangentially involved in the drug scheme. Again,
and
there's
so
nothing.
So then here's Davidovic talking about the Haitian guy. It seems to me the government gets in evidence under nicknames, under allusions all the time. I was troubled that you had perhaps not drawn the line properly between 608B and 613 here.
Well, I respectfully disagree with that. But the other thing I'd mentioned is during Mr. Davidovic's testimony, he had never said anything at all about Selmo Cadet or any other Haitian person. So if it is impeachment evidence, what's being impeached? what part of his testimony is being impeached. If he says nothing about a Haitian person and here's this letter, I lied about a Haitian person, what exactly is being impeached?
His statement that denying that he ever lied in this case or intended to lie in this case, that's what's being impeached. He was asked on cross-examination whether he's ever told anyone that you've lied in this case or intended to lie in this particular case. He says no. He says never.
Yes.
He says never. And then, in fact,
I have the question you asked right in front of me here. So the keys, you know, this particular case, you know, he's asked nothing about a Haitian. He never said anything about a Haitian person. He might think that's a completely different case than these four people that are on trial. And that's
the point of giving him the extrinsic evidence, to give him an opportunity to explain it. That's the thrust of 613.
And he was asked, the court permitted defense counsel to examine him outside of the presence of the jury, and that type of question was never asked. He was never asked, well, what do you mean by this particular case? So I think even if you look at this and you say, well, you know, the judge and the prosecutor screwed up here and looked at 608B when they should have looked at 613, and maybe we weren't on the right side of the line there. I think if you consider it under general impeachment rules like 613, this evidence is so clearly tangential that it's not a proper impeachment in any event. Well, having said that, unless the court has any more questions about that issue, I wanted to proceed to kind of the second issue that's a little bit off of the beaten path, and that is the identification of the voices of LaFrederick Taylor and Kamal Sims based upon hearing their speech in the court proceedings. And the issue that's a little bit more off the beaten path here is the Fifth Amendment issue. In that spin on it. And I wanted to note a couple of things. The basic thing that happened here, of course, is Detective Simpson hears them speak in court proceedings and partially identifies their voices based on hearing them in court. Number one, there's no evidence that the judge or anyone else compelled them to testify in court. So this wasn't compelled testimony. Number two, the content of their speech, what they said in court, was not introduced into evidence. We were only talking about characteristics of their voice that were referred to. The third thing that's important...
So it's your position that's just not testimonial?
Yes, yes. And the third thing that's important here to consider is that there were alternative bases from which the jury could identify, or could, the jury can, could conclude the identifications were proper. In Kamal Sims' case, Detective Simpson interviewed him for about 10 minutes after his arrest. With respect to LaFrederick Taylor, there were telephone calls played at trial where he's talking to David Neighbors on the phone, hey, I'll meet you over at the A, and then the police see the two of them meet at Adams Avenue, so that corroborated the voice identification there. But the main thing is under Hubanks versus Frank, which I cited in my brief, this court has ruled that even compelling a defendant to speak does not violate the Fifth Amendment, where we're using it as an identifying characteristic as opposed to testimonial. And in this case, they weren't even compelled to testify, so it's a stronger case for the government. Very briefly, there are five other issues. They've all been resolved, in my view, by either the Supreme Court or this court. Issue about placing the burden of proving the systematic exclusion of African Americans from the jury pool under the government, is this court has recognized you'd have to reverse Duren to reach the conclusion that the appellants want. The second...
Let me ask you, is this an unusual situation in the Southern District where a pool of this size would come in?
It depends where you are in the Southern District, and I've tried cases, a substantial number of cases, in three of the four venues that our court, divisions that our court has. In the Evansville Division and the Terre Haute Division, I wouldn't say it is unusual. The populations are more rural. I remember picking juries in both of those divisions before where there weren't any African-American jurors. Now, if you ask me, is that in Indianapolis, I'd say that would be very unusual, but that's not the case in Terre Haute and Evansville. So going ahead to the objection to the jury's review of the transcripts, and I'd again conclude that they were introduced into evidence at trial. I think the courts pointed out that implicitly objection overruled means
they
come in.
You concede that you'd have a worse problem if they hadn't been?
Yeah, I think so, because I've never in 17, 18 years of doing this presented something to a jury that hadn't been admitted. Don't think you can do that.
No, I don't either. That's why it's too bad you didn't get a clear ruling from the court. You know, these are admitted and marked as exhibits, whatever they were.
Yeah, and
what
I
about
think
Judge Sykes' question about the exhibit list? Surely if they were exhibits.
Absolutely. I can state with certainty that it was checked as being admitted because it's my practice, and I did it in this case, that I review every piece of evidence that goes out to the jury, and I review what both the court has checked and I have checked in our exhibit list. And you will find, if you look at the clerk's sheet, that it was checked as admitted. And I agree with you. It'd be great if he would have said it's admitted, but that's sometimes what happens in two-week jury trials when you have, 300, 400 exhibits coming in. You don't always get perfection. So that's the situation. I think the Dorr case and the Breland case both support the district court's rulings in this matter. The third question was the sufficiency of the voice identification testimony. And I wanted to emphasize that the legal standard here isn't clear and convincing evidence. Under the Resendez case, which this court handed down this year, it's a minimal familiarity standard. And it's absolutely the case that if the defendants at a trial stage have questions about, did the police officer speak with the person long enough? Did they listen to the tapes enough? Those types of questions don't affect the admissibility of the evidence. They go to the weight of the evidence, and that's the Alvarez case, and that's the relevant legal principle here. The fourth issue that this court's resolved a lot is the variance issue between the indictment and trial evidence. And I did want to make a sort of factual argument to counter what Mr. Tullis said. He said there is absolutely no evidence of powder cocaine. Well, DEA seized, 9 ounces of powder cocaine and 13.5 ounces of crack cocaine, or the reverse, I might have my numbers reversed, from David Neighbors when he was driving back from to Louisville to Evansville during the course of the conspiracy. So there was evidence of both crack and powder admitted. I don't know what the jury did in reaching their verdicts, and that's always, you ask what did the jury do, that's always a very dangerous question to ask. But in this situation, there was evidence of both powder and crack presented, and this idea that they've raised in their brief that the government was laying in wait to spring this evidence just isn't the case here. And when you look at these variance issues, as this court has held many times, the Williams case I cited, for instance, when there's a variance issue raised, the question that this court raises is, well, was the evidence sufficient to support the convictions of these people? And I think it's very strong, and it's strong enough.
But there's still, I think you might be using those cases a bit out of context. Certainly, people who are charged with a broad conspiracy, and they say, no, it was two or three different smaller conspiracies, if the evidence was enough to support the smaller conspiracy, maybe shorter in time, maybe smaller in geography, maybe not as many people, then those convictions are upheld. Here, as I understand their argument, which on a clean slate might be somewhat persuasive, is that if you're charged of doing one and two, then all of that has to be proved before you can be found guilty. You can't be found guilty if you did only one or only two. Now, as it happens, none of the law seems to support that. The law all seems to say that when the government charges in the conjunctive, it actually means it's disjunctive. So if that's the law, then you charged in the conjunctive and you proved one part of it.
Okay.
I think that's really all it is.
Okay, I'll take it. I think that's certainly. The last issue I wanted to raise was the matter of Mr. Perry's sentencing, and he was sentenced at the top of the guideline range. And, of course, I'm sure this court has had hundreds of cases, and I've read many of these opinions where the presumption of validity attaches to a sentence within the guideline range. And Mr. Perry was just a career offender, and that's where he comes out. He was in the guideline, a career offender guideline, and I think it's reasonable. There's really nothing that the defense, the appellants have pointed out here that would even really justify a departure from the range. No one's making the argument that Mr. Perry's a good guy here. So with that in mind, I don't have anything else. I don't think I have to use all of my time. So unless the court has any more questions of me, that's all.
Thank you, Mr. Blake.
Thank you very much.
Mr. O'Daniel.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
I should use this time to address just a couple of the issues Mr. Blackington had spoke about and the court had questions about. The first with regard to the Davidic letters, I think the court's right that 613 is the analysis. It is prior inconsistent statements used for impeachment. Also, it is a co-conspirator statement. He was charged in this and was sectioned out by at least a proffer and potential plea agreement.
Well, it may actually yes. be both. Both rules may be implicated here based on how the testimony went and
sure.
the how the offer of proof went as well. And then what's the right answer? If the evidence qualifies under both rules and the rules are in conflict, which trumps?
Well, I think we resolved those issues in favor of the defendant. He has a right to present a defense, and it was not allowed to be done in this particular case. Clearly, Mr. Davidovic was relied upon by the prosecution. They thought his testimony to be reliable. Clearly, they did not anticipate that he would lie on the stand or have other statements by virtue of the written evidence that might be used against him. With regard to whether it was tangential or not, there were two calls that referenced Haitian Mo, which was Selmo Condette. He was the only Haitian reference within the body of the calls that were presented, and so clearly he was part of this and not just tangential. If he was tangential, they didn't need to use him in the first place. But as soon as his calls came in, then I think that those were fair game. With regards to the voice identification and the like of the in-room or in-courtroom statements, and this is referenced in page 24 of the brief, I think that in addition to what we talked about, there is somewhat of a chilling effect to individuals who are directly questioned by the court, whether it be identifiers, whether you understand it or otherwise, and not being told that anything they say or do could be used against them by Detective Simpson, Detective Freiberger, or a government witness who is using that to bolster or further identify the voices. Mr. Blackington is right. There is no expectation of privacy within the voice, but this goes more towards a Fifth Amendment argument of self-incrimination. They were not told that their voice may be used against them pursuant to direct questions by the court as to whether they understand the charges or anything of that nature.
But if a compulsory voice exemplar is permissible and doesn't violate the self-incrimination clause, then why
they should ask for it. There's a procedure by which to do that. You petition the court by our motion to the court, whether it be for fingerprint, voice, DNA, whatever it might be. There's a way by which to do it. They usurped that. They didn't give the opportunity to object to it. Thirdly, with regards to the question that Mr. Blackington, would it be unusual in the Southern District of Indiana, whether it be Terre Haute or Evansville, to have an all-white venire? My opinion would be yes. I've done this for 13 years now, and I've not had a situation where an entire venire, whether it be in Evansville or in federal court, was of an all-white makeup, for what it's worth. And then lastly, with the admission of the transcripts, the court indicated, and you know, maybe the clerk's exhibit had it. However, we don't have that before us today, and I think Mr. Blackington is right. Maybe in a perfect world, the court would have said, yes, they are admitted, or no, they aren't. In the absence of it, it should be resolved in favor of the defendant. I think Mr. Blackington used the word, you know, it would be great if we had, you know, perfection. But I think this court must demand perfection. When we're sentencing people to life in prison, 20 years, 27 years, we need to demand perfection, not only for the attorneys, but also from the court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. O'Daniel. Our thanks to all counsel. Mr. O'Daniel, Mr. Groves, Mr. Tellis, and Ms. Williams, I want to extend on behalf of the court an additional thanks for accepting the appointment and presenting the issues in this case.
Thank you.